Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 6, Chapter 1, The History of the Life of Ajamiyo, Text Number 20. Atra chodaharantimam itihasam paratanam dutanam Vishnu Yamayo Sambhadastam Nibodhame Atra. In this connection, Cha also Udaharanti. They give as an example Imam this. Itihasam, the history of Ajamila, Paratanam, which is very old, Dutanam, of the order of carriers, Vishnu, of Lord Vishnu, Yamayo, and of Yamaraj, Sambada, the discussion, Tam, that, Nibodha, try to understand, May, from me. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. In this regard, learned scholars and saintly persons describe a very old historical incident involving a discussion between the order carriers of Lord Vishnu and those of Yamaraj. Please hear this from me. Please repeat. In this regard, learned scholars and saintly persons describe a very old historical incident involving a discussion between the order carriers of Lord Vishnu and those of Yamaraj. Please hear this from me. Purport, the Puranas or old histories are sometimes neglected by unintelligent men who consider their descriptions mythological. Actually, the descriptions of the Puranas or the old histories of the universe are factual, although not chronological. The Puranas record the chief incidents that have occurred over many millions of years, not only in this planet, but also on other planets within the universe. Therefore, all learned and realized Vedic scholars speak with references to the incidents in the Puranas. Srila Rupa Goswami accepts the Puranas to be as important as the Vedas themselves. Therefore, in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, he quotes the following verse from the Brahma Yamala. Shruti Smriti Paranadi Pancharatra Vidim Vina Ait Kantiki Harir Bhaktir Utpathayaiva Kalpate. Devotional service of the Lord that ignores the authorized Vedic literatures like the Upanishads, Puranas, and Narada Pancharatra is simply an unnecessary disturbance in society. The devotee of the Lord must refer not only to the Vedas, but also to the Puranas. One should not foolishly consider the Puranas mythological as if they were mythological. If they were mythological, Shukadeva Goswami would not have taken the trouble to recite the old historical incidents concerning the life of Ajamila. Now the history begins as follows. Atra chodaharantimam itihasam paratanam dutanam Vishnu Yamayo sambadastam nivodame. In this regard, learned scholars and saintly persons describe a very old historical incident involving a discussion between the order carriers of Lord Vishnu and those of Yamaraj. Now please hear this from me. Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Pristaya Bhutale Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swami Tanamane Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Pracharane Nirvishesha Srinivadi Paskatyade Satarne. The following story will come from the Puranas, and Purana means old. So old means that things in this universe are not always as they are right now, and that although we've been misdirected by so-called scientists who themselves are misdirected, they've created a conception of the universe which is entirely fictitious. It's not really science, it's science fiction. Anyone, we could read Judah Karmapuru's books, which is, he didn't make up, which are based upon the available scientific evidence found in different literatures over the last couple hundred years. And there we can see that actually the scientists are not really scientists. They're science fiction writers. Because they themselves, well, science is supposed to be based upon a number of things. First of all, there should be some kind of theory. And based on that theory, we do experiments. And based on that those experiments, we have observations, and then we reach a conclusion. But the so-called scientists have already reached the conclusion. And whether they do experiments or not, they'll fight for their conclusion. And if they find out, if they have things to observe and they don't fit their conclusion, they just eliminate them, ignore them. And if someone is so bold, well, this is called the knowledge filter. Knowledge filter means they just ignore it. It's an anomaly, it didn't really exist. Sometimes they find artifacts in the earth, in strata, because that's how they judge how old something is, which is billions of years old. They find some pottery. But that can't exist. So since it can't exist, they just eliminate it. In other words, if you find pottery, if they're using a standard of measurement for antiquity, the earth strata, or if they use some carbon radiation, whatever they do, carbon dating, but say they use the earth strata as a measurement of how old something is, and they find something billions of years old, do you think, well, some human artifact in a strata which is they conceive of as being billions of years old, do you think they change the history and say that people lived billions of years ago? No, they just throw out the pottery, and that's it. Only when the data collects so much that they can't ignore it, that they may push back human life, human existence, a few thousand years. In other words, the history that we find out in the textbooks or in the museums is not history at all. It's people's imagination. And basically speaking, the whole aim is godlessness. Because if they push history back too much, then everything gets scrambled, then their evolutionary theory becomes revealed as being completely bogus. Not completely bogus. Prabhupada said there's such a thing as evolution, that although it's not as Darwin conceived of it, is that there are different there is an evolution of species, but the species are created at once. Certainly, most human beings are more intelligent than monkeys. But monkeys and human beings have always lived together. They were both created simultaneously. And therefore, we find in the history of the Ramayana that there were intelligent monkeys. And there were actually intelligent human beings, too. And they live together. Well, not necessarily together in the same house, but they live together in the same planet. The Varnas and the human beings at that time. Now, why they don't find them in the strata? Because they've only examined one, I think it's something like 1%, 0.1% of the strata, which means they haven't really examined practically anything. And besides that, they used to burn the bodies. So, and if they, for instance, they found one footprint of a man, and next to the footprint was a footprint of a dinosaur. So that's certainly an anomaly. Man had a pet dinosaur. He was walking it. So they just ignore it. So where, what men were doing, what the if there were any dinosaurs, the big lizards, this is, we haven't, the Vedic literature doesn't, as far as I know, doesn't mention dinosaurs. It mentions that men in Dwarpa Yuga were much bigger than they are now. For instance, when Muchukunda went out of the cave, he saw the trees and he thought they were bushes. That everyone appeared to be like a pygmy. And that's Dwarpa Yuga, what to speak of Treta Yuga. In Dwarpa Yuga, Krishna was a Kshatriya. The Kshatriyas at that time were 6 meters high. And Krishna was rather short. He was only 5 meters high. He was quite small for Kshatriya. Therefore, he'd get away with being a Vaishya, somewhat. Indeed, when they went to fight against Jarasandha, then Jarasandha thought, well, these couldn't be Brahmins. I mean, Bhima is 6 meters high, pretty big for a Brahmin. they're built like Kshatriyas. Besides that, they have marks on their shoulders of carrying a bow. Therefore, he concluded they must be Kshatriyas, but because they've degraded themselves into appearing before me as beggars, therefore whatever they want, I'll give them. Even if they ask for my head, I'll give it to them. Which is quite generous. In any case, what we hear of history within our so-called history books is all, for the most part, it's people's. Well, it's hard to say. There's a cheating propensity, which is quite evident in science. And then they have the imperfect senses, which is also quite evident. And subject to illusion also. And committing mistakes. So they're all present in the so-called histories. Whoever wins the war, they write the history, for instance. And what... if the Germans would have won World War II, then all the American heroes would have been demons. And all the demons in the German army and the German would have been the demigods. So whoever wins, they write the history and everything is... they try to get people to perceive from that perspective. But factually, the Vedas are also quite inconceivable to people. Which sometimes makes it harder for people to accept them. But actually, the Vedas are not meant for stories. Although some of the information given there, and the Puranas especially, seems to be completely fantastic. That there is, for instance, in Srimad Bhagavatam in the 5th canto, there's a mountain, and it's 100,000 yojanas high. So that's a yojana is conceived of 8 miles, which I guess is around 12 kilometers, which means that the mountain is 120,000 kilometers high. No, it's not. It's 1,200,000 kilometers high. Is that right? Yeah, 1,200,000. So How far is it from here to, say, Zagreb? 130. So it's around 100,000 times more. How long it would take to get from here to Zagreb? Probably an hour, say. So if it was 100,000 times more, that would be 100,000 hours, which if we take 25 hours, that would be, in a day, it would be 4,000 days. And if we take 365 and just round it off, it would be 1,000 years to get there, traveling at that rate. That's how far away it is. So if you were at the base of Mount Meru and you had a lift that was going to approximately the same speed as a car going to Zagreb, it would take you over 1,000 years to get to the top. And that mountain is made out of gold. So most people would just be chipping away at the base, trying to get whatever they can, take it home. What's that? Yeah, anyhow, the base is probably big enough. We can chip a little bit away at it. Because after all, on the top, it says there lives Lord Brahma and his kingdom and all the demigods, so the base must be pretty big too. Otherwise, you chip it away, it starts falling. You chip away a little gold out, and the whole thing topples over. You see Brahma, like, ah! No, it's, compared to us, it must be quite a huge base. So it sounds quite, well, for us, it's fantastic. It's something you read to your children at night before they take rest. This fairy tale about the mountain, the golden mountain. And the four-headed man living on top of it. So why is it in the Puranas, there's these fantastic stories. We're already faithless. We don't even know we're not this body. We can hardly believe that. What to speak of acting on the basis of being a spiritual soul. And then they're introducing four-headed men riding on swans. Born out of lotus flowers. Now we've heard our parents sometimes tell children, parents, that when the children ask where they come from, they say you've come from the stalk. And when the children grow up, they think, oh, my parents, they were just trying to deflect me from, because they don't know where I came from. Well, obviously they know, but anyhow, they didn't want to tell me. They thought I was too young and innocent. So they told me I came from the stalk. But we tell people, where did Brahma came from? He came from a flower. So, which is more believable? Someone came from a stalk, or he came from a flower? And he's not just an ordinary person. He has four heads. And from him, the whole universe comes. So this sounds quite fantastic to most people. And even it would seem fantastic to us if we just didn't ignore it within our minds. Because we get what's called inoculated or immune to hearing these things. Otherwise, we start thinking some man with four heads on top of a flower from someone's navel that came, who was lying on a snake in an ocean that he himself created from his perspiration. And then at the same time, he has his wife massaging his legs. You'd wonder if his wife would get tired after some time doing this for some trillions of years. So, why is this all introduced to us? Is it to test our faith? No, because we hardly have any faith. We'd fail the test. So why is it? Because the stories in the Puranas have principles behind them. that even if we don't accept the story itself, there's no reason to accept it blindly or to reject it blindly. But there's principles behind the stories. And if we accept the principles, then gradually the knowledge is revealed to us. In other words, we become Krishna conscious. And the most amazing thing is Krishna consciousness. Everything else is quite ordinary in comparison to Krishna consciousness. To tell us that there are mountains made of gold in the universe, well, we have gold, we have the experience of gold. So if there was a mountain of gold, it wouldn't be so unusual in one sense, although quite extraordinary. But spiritual energy is a completely different nature. It's unlimited. Now, we ourselves have some experience of spiritual energy. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. For instance, that the name of Krishna and Krishna himself are spiritual. Whether they're exactly the same or not, that may be inconceivable to us at the present moment because we're not enough Krishna conscious to know who Krishna is. So we don't know what the name is, we don't know who Krishna is, so whether they're equal or not, we have no idea because we don't know neither of them. But the fact that they're spiritual, that's perceivable to us just by chanting Hare Krishna. Because otherwise, how can we keep on chanting 16 rounds a day or even less or more than that and come back every day to do it unless we're all crazy? Because we are crazy, but we're not that crazy. No one would come back and sit in a temple room and chant, Mary has a little lamb, her sheep was white as snow, and everywhere that Mary went, the lamb was sure to go. You heard that before? No? American propaganda. That's an American nursery rhyme. But anyhow, everyone has their nursery rhymes. But we're not going to sit here and chant Donald Duck, Mickey Mouse, because we get bored. Because we get bored chanting Hare Krishna too, but that's a different story. That's not due to the fact that we're bored chanting Hare Krishna, it's the fact that we're not chanting Hare Krishna. It's the fact that we're not listening, our mind went somewhere else to Never Never Land. But we can verbally and loudly chant Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck, and we'll get bored after some time. But if we loudly chant Hare Krishna, we'll notice that it's Nityanava Navayamana. It's always new and fresh. What material sound, what material word is always new and fresh? There's no material word. No one has written any book that people read every day. Could you name any book that people read every day? Mundane book? Oh, after some time, even the best story they get bored with. But we can read Bhagavad Gita every day and find new understanding, new realizations. So it must be spiritual. That's what we mean by spiritual. It's always new and fresh and always more and more enlightening. So although we may not know the nature of the Puranas, for instance, Srimad Bhagavatam is a Purana, but if we read the Bhagavatam, even a verse of it, again and again, it's always new and fresh. And after a while, it'll become more and more experienced by us. At the same time, that doesn't mean we're going to accept or have any experience of mountains or people with three eyes riding on bulls or warriors white riding on swans. We may not get any experience like that, but it really is not necessary to get any of that experience to go back to Godhead. It's not that before we get back to the spiritual world, the gatekeepers ask us, how many heads does your Brahma have? We say, three. You're wrong. Go back. No, there's no qualification to even know Srimad Bhagavatam. We just have to know Krishna in order to go back to the spiritual world. But here we'll find, I guess, a story which is not so inconceivable to us, but comes from the Puranas, someone who is chanting the name of Narayan. And, of course, it's a little inconceivable that the Yamadutas will come. Of course, within our mundane literature, within our mundane magazines and things like that, there are testimony of nurses who say that at the time of death, people have such hallucinations. And there's even a name for it in the terminology of the hospitals, which I can't remember the terminology, but something about end-of-life hallucinations. Because many people have this. There was one devotee, and she went to the hospital, and her mother was there, or her father, and he kept on pointing. He said, "They're coming for me. I can hear the dogs barking." And I saw these horrible-looking men. It is said, or at least I heard, I didn't read it, that Stalin's daughter, when Stalin was leaving his body, he pointed to these people who had come, and they seemed to be, you know, trying to drag me away. There are many people who report hearing these dogs barking, the hounds of hell barking, and people coming, these strange-looking people, coming and dragging them away. So it's not just in the Srimad Bhagavatam, it's in the testimonies of people leaving their bodies or about to leave their bodies. Now, whether that's true or not, the fact is we're going to leave our body. Very few people have given testimonies that I know of the Vishnu Dutas coming to take them away. But that's probably because we're in Kali Yuga. The only one I know of is Tukaram. According to the history, which Tukaram lived at the time of Lord Chaitanya, when he was such a great devotee, at one time a UFO came, unidentified flying object, but it was identified as a Vaikuntha airplane. So everyone calm down, it's not a UFO. It's a Vaikuntha airplane, you know, don't worry about it. And Tukaram boarded the airplane plane and went back to Vaikuntha. So that's their testimonies from the villages. Of course, scientists will not accept these testimonies, but we can accept them. Scientists, as I said, they have their knowledge filter. In the 19th century, which is the 1800s, then one of the topmost scientists at that time, I think his name is Wallace. He was a co-founder of the theory of evolution with Charles Darwin. He was called to a hotel with many of the top scientists in Europe, and they were asked to witness a phenomenon. The man who called them to the hotel opened the hotel. He was on the second floor of the hotel window, and he walked out the window. Everyone's direct perception, and he walked back. And all the scientists reported that they can verify that this man was levitating. But when the scientists in America heard this, they said, "Oh, they were all just hallucinating." And that was the end of that scientific investigation and levitation. In other words, if you don't want to see something, if you don't want to accept something, it doesn't exist, to you at least. So whether we perceive the Yamadutas or we perceive the Vishnudutas, this particular section of the Bhagavatam will try to get us to chant Hare Krishna. And that we can perceive. We can perceive that we're eternal souls, so that means just by that point of view, when we hear Krishna speaking Bhagavad Gita, that the body's changing, but the soul's not changing, then we can see that whatever I'm thinking is just wrong anyhow. I have no idea what reality is, because I don't even know who I am. I'm living in a hallucination. My hallucination is this bodily existence. I'm hallucinating that I'm this body, just as I'm hallucinating I'm dreaming at night. that I have a different form than I presently have. So from that point of view, we should become humble, and therefore when we read the Vedas, or the Puranas, or the Srimad Bhagavatam, it should be to try to find the keys to get out of our hallucination, to wake up out of our dreamlike existence, to become aware of who we actually are and what reality is. Now, we don't have to accept every part of the story, as I said again, but all we do is have to find the keys in the stories, the themes behind the stories, the reasons why the stories are included in the Bhagavatam, to help lead us out of darkness back to Krishna consciousness again. Because we have to accept, after hearing Bhagavad Gita, that we're eternal. We also have to accept that there's a God, and it's not us. Even if we don't see the real God, the Supreme God, at least we have to see how time is changing everything. Completely beyond our influence and control, at every moment time is changing our very existence. So time is changing everything, but time is not changing. So time in this world is supreme. That energy of time, whoever it might be, or whatever it might be, is supreme here. And no one can change time. But time is moving with some intelligence. That's why the planets move in their orbits. That's why we can eat food and digest it, assimilate it, and eliminate the unnecessary parts. So time is not moving arbitrarily. It's moving with great intelligence, supreme intelligence. And supreme intelligence implies that time is controlled by a supremely intelligent person. So we have to accept God, and we have to accept that we're souls, and we have to accept the fact that we're an illusion, and the Bhagavatam was given to us to help us get out of illusion. So if we take the Bhagavatam seriously, follow its directions, get the clues to our liberation from the Bhagavatam and the Bhagavad Gita, and follow it, then we'll become liberated, and after some time, whether these stories are not or true, it won't make any difference to us, but generally speaking, since the Bhagavatam will lead us out of darkness, we'll have more of a tendency to have at least faith in the stories, even if we don't have to go and meet Indra or Brahma or Shiva or take a, you know, trip up the mountain, Meru. It won't be necessary. We'll already have faith that the Bhagavatam is absolute knowledge and that what it's talking about is our liberation from material misconceptions into the real conception of being Krishna's eternal servant. Now that's all it's meant for. Not to bewilder us, confuse us. It's meant for our ultimate liberation. Now just one more thing. Why would the Bhagavatam have so many unusual stories? Because for some people these stories who are on a more elevated platform or who will be on a more elevated platform, they're not so unusual, but they're perfect histories. They illustrate points perfectly that no other history can illustrate in the same way. Unless there was an out-of-body experience by a sinful person like Ajamil, how would we be able to perceive the power of the holy name? What else would illustrate? Unless Prahlad Maharaj was put into such difficulty, how would we perceive the power of chanting Hare Krishna? So extreme examples are given to give vivid examples or vivid illustrations of the power of something. Unless Prahlad was put into difficulty, we wouldn't understand how powerful is the name, how powerful is the deliverer by deliverance by Lord Nrisimhadev. Therefore, the conclusion is the Bhagavatam may be full of unusual things, but then again, our very material existence right now is, from the point of view of the Bhagavatam, quite unusual. We may think it's normal, but from the point of view of the Bhagavatam, we're living in a crazy hallucination. The sages, when they heard that some shudra was beating on a cow, they couldn't believe it. Such a thing was unheard of. But in our crazy hallucination in the Kali Yuga nowadays, it would be considered completely normal. So rather than take our present existence as normal, we should take it as a horrible delusion and try to wake up out of it by following the path given to us by the great acharyas and the shastras, and ultimately coming from Krishna. So I'll stop there. Thank you. Any questions? Yes.
Is it like this, that people in Satya Yuga are more God conscious than in other yugas? And if it is so, so are these the same living beings as were there at the end of Kali Yuga? So they just get higher consciousness or...
Yes. Well, you asked a number of questions. One is, of course, they're more God conscious. Everyone is God conscious, and as we become purified, we become more God conscious. It's not that some people are conscious of God and He pops into existence, and other people are unconscious of God and He pops out of existence. But consciousness means to become conscious of Krishna. As far as how it happens, well, at the end of Kali Yuga, there are a few devotees left who haven't been eaten. And they take Krishna consciousness probably quite seriously at the end of Kali Yuga. They're quite attached to Krishna. That's why they're not eaten. They're quite conscious. Of course, there is some kind of, generally between the different yugas, is a Sunday. But what happens during that Sunday, I don't know. And how these great personalities at the end of Kali Yuga are transformed into the personalities in Satya Yuga, that I don't know. Because Satya Yuga is quite different from Kali Yuga. I don't know. I haven't read any description of it. But that's what it's described, that people remaining at the end of Kali Yuga make it into Satya Yuga. Anything else? All right, thank you very much. Grantharaj Shrimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Gaur Premanande.